Welcome to Locked On Heat. My name is Wes Goldberg. My co-host, David Romil, will be joining me in a minute, along with Locked On Cavaliers host, Chris Manning, who asked David and I to join his show to talk about the effects of LeBron James leaving your team. Of course, the Heat dealt with that in 2014, and the Cavs are dealing with that now. We get into how the Heat have responded over the last few years since LeBron left, the struggles and lessons the Cavs can learn in rebuilding after LeBron, and the oftentimes jarring differences between watching and covering a LeBron-led team and watching one without him. We talk a lot of Heat, LeBron, and Cavs, and how all of them are connected, so we hope you enjoy it. Thanks, of course, for listening and for subscribing. If you're not already, you could do so on iTunes. Feel free to leave us a 5-star review to support the show. And if you use Spotify, be sure to follow us there, too. It's a great way to listen to podcasts. Now, let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, I'm Chris Manning from Locked On Cavaliers, as well as FearTheSword.com. And this is a crossover show. It's a episode talking a lot about LeBron, but without really talking about LeBron. And who better to do that with David Romil and Wes Goldberg from Locked On Heat. David, Wes, what's up, guys?
Doing pretty good. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing good. Wes, it's been how are you guys dealing with the offseason generally? I mean, we're deep into it, but are you guys ready for it?
Well, you guys have had a lot more activity in Cleveland than we have in Miami. So it's kind of, you know, when the season ended, we had a group of guys on the team. And a couple months later, it's still basically the same group of guys on the team, minus basically like Jordan, Mickey, and Luke Babbitt, David, right? Essentially, it's the same group. So we've kind of just been sitting here twiddling our thumbs, wondering if Dwayne Wade's going to go play in China or not. That's kind of, it's been much more exciting for the Cavaliers than it has been for the Heat.
That's Cavaliers lifer Dwayne Wade for those people that are not aware.
No. David, I think we have to bleep that out when we run this on Locked On Heat.
I had to make sure I got that in. But we're talking about today LeBron James, and he is the player in this summer, obviously leaving the Cavs, and 4 years ago leaving the Heat. He's like one of the few guys that in the league that I think when he leaves your team and he leaves your franchise, it drastically changes you. And like, I don't know how many guys there exactly are. It's probably like what Steph, it'll be like that if Giannis or Anthony Davis ever left their team, and you could go down the list, but LeBron is the one that seismically changes your franchise when he leaves. So I want to start by going back to 2014, going back to LeBron. He leaves Miami or leaves Miami to go back to Cleveland. And I'm trying to avoid talking about LeBron and his $500 Laker shorts for as long as possible. But when LeBron leaves, what did the Heat do that summer? What were their steps as we look back at that to move on from the best player in the world and the guy who was the lead of the Heatles?
Well, you kind of have to go back to right before he leaves, where Pat Riley made his first moves, you know, drafting Shabazz Napier. At signing Danny Granger, getting Josh McRoberts, and then kind of moving forward from there. So those were steps that were everybody was looking as, you know, obviously fringe moves to kind of build the team around LeBron, who many in the Heat organization assumed would re-sign with Miami. Then they kind of take the punch to the gut, as Riley has said a number of times, and looked at LeBron's departure and then immediately started moving forward. So they actually did, I think, an admirable job of trying to regroup as quickly as well as possible. They were able to re-sign Dwayne Wade, who many forget was also a free agent in 2014. Obviously, they also re-signed Chris Bosh, throwing a max contract at him in 2014. And then they were able to kind of not necessarily duplicate what LeBron provides, but they signed Luol Deng as well in that summer. So they had a pretty decent team. They got Chris Anderson back. I think Mario Chalmers was also a free agent. So they basically rebuilt almost the same exact team that was there in 2014. Ray Allen departed as a free agent that summer, but they tried their best to try to recreate the team as it was before, minus LeBron and with Luol Deng, Granger, and McRoberts added to the roster. So it was a pretty good facsimile and one that at least immediately spoke of playoff contention. They weren't going to regroup. They weren't going to tear down the team as many people assumed they might You know, they had to convince Bosch to re-sign. I think Wade was a little bit easier to convince to come back to Miami, being the only team he had played for up to that point. So to me, I think it was, you know, a really good effort to try and keep that same team and move forward with the idea that they were going to continue to contend for the playoffs, if not necessarily for a title.
Yeah, and let's not forget, afterwards, the Goran Dragic trade went down, and I think that was a really big deal for Miami, and it's something I think Cleveland in particular can look to, because Miami traded two first-round picks for what they thought was going to be an all-NBA point guard, and yeah, Goran Dragic made the All-Star game last year, and he's been a really good player for Miami, and has probably had more of a locker room presence than they may have been expecting as far as having a leadership role on the team. But that was a big deal, you know, trading away two major assets like those two first-round picks in order to get Dragic. And so there was this idea that they would be forming a new big three with Goran Dragic at point guard, Dwayne Wade at shooting guard, and then Chris Bosh in the front court. And, of course, things went down with Chris Bosh and the blood clots, and then Dwayne Wade ended up going or leaving a year after that. And then it basically was just Goran Dragic after that. And you know, he obviously hasn't been the all-NBA point guard that he was that one year in Phoenix, and he's probably underperformed in that respect. But in other ways, he's been a really important part of the roster. But I think Cleveland can sort of look at that, and you could argue that Pat Riley may have tried to jumpstart the rebuild a little bit or avoid the rebuild completely in trading draft picks for Dragic. And like I said, the Cavaliers in their post-LeBron rebuild could look at that and say, well, do we want to mortgage the future a little bit in order to remain competitive, or do we want to just kind of let this thing go?
That to me is the part of this that I find very hard to gauge. The Cavs, I think, had a choice. And I think they had to, you can look at their move for the last year, and you could, I think, see on the raw and the writing on the wall for them and saying, okay, we're preparing in case LeBron leaves. You go back to the Kyrie Irving trade. They didn't flip Kyrie for the best player right now that fit with LeBron. It was the Nets pick that ended up being Colin Sexton. Mm-hmm. And how they didn't trade that pick all year. They could have flipped that for something at some point and said, we're going to try to win right now. But they decided that, okay, we can't do that. That's bad asset management. It's also like a very interesting thing to me that the Heat obviously are renowned for their culture, right? The Heat are renowned for their ability to get guys that come in, they get in incredible shape, they play in the Spoelstra system under the guidance of Pat Riley, the Tywin Lannister of the NBA. And they're efficient, they get things done, and they maximize sort of what they have. And of course, that year that you were talking about, this is pre-Hassan Whiteside as we know him now. This is Wade playing 62 games. This is, you know, Danny Granger still is in the NBA, and this is the Shannon Brown's on this roster. Michael Beasley's on this roster. This is a 37 win team, if I'm correct here. So it didn't, you know, you obviously don't get to the same heights, but they kind of had faith in what I find really interesting. And I wonder if the Cavs are trying to do this as well without the same kind of track record. To me, it's, and you guys would certainly know better than me, so tell me if this is a crazy read on this, but the Heat, starting with that first year, really just banked on themselves as an organization. They said, okay, we didn't want to lose LeBron, but we did. So now going forward, we are going to look at developing what we have, maximizing everything that we have, without saying our culture, our ability to develop and improve and maximize what we have, and relying on Eric and Pat and everyone we have here. And obviously the Bosch thing certainly throws the issues he had through a kink in this, but it's using those things we already have and what we're really good at to define us and rise up without having to go full Philadelphia and try to tank to get Embiid and Simmons and draft that way. It was, we're not going to do that. We're going to just go for what we believe we can do and what defines us. And I don't know if you deem the last 4 years a success and how you would really rate that, but I find that is a very interesting way. And it's the way that seems like, to some degree, some people might view that as bad roster management. I know there's a lot of people that I know that are Cavs fans or media members that don't understand why the Cavs aren't tanking, but I kind of get it.
We'll be right back.
You know, as much of a loss as LeBron James was in 2014, being able to, you know, recapture Bosch at the same time or just a few days later, was a huge step for Riley and for the Heat fandom, I think, to say, you know what, we're still engaged, we're still committed to trying to win as much as possible. And then for him to lose half that season, I mean, he went down right after the All-Star break, right at the trade deadline. From the reports that we know now, the move to acquire Goran Dragic took place right before he found out about, or right before he found out about Bosch. And so that kind of really changed things a lot. They assumed that Bosch was going to be able to come back at some point. They didn't know how much it was going to take out of him. And then he tried to come back next year, went through the same process where he was only able to play half the season. By that point, you've got Justice Winslow, you've got Josh Richardson, you've got Hassan Whiteside. So they were moving forward, trying to contend and hoping that, as you said, they could bank on developing their players internally. And that did work to some degree. I mean, like I said, they had those rookies, Winslow and Richardson. They had Whiteside, who turned around from, you know, a player that was out of the league to a really strong defender, rebounder, rim protector, et cetera. You know, they had Tyler Johnson, who went undrafted and was able to build himself into a quality role player. So all those pieces surrounding the two superstars that they thought they were going to have seemed to make for a strong playoff contender, not a team that was going to rebuild completely. And again, like I said, I think it was a positive because you made the playoffs. You were trying this. You were trying to win as many games as possible. And you never know in the Eastern Conference if Bosch had stayed healthy, if you had gelled a little bit quicker between Dragic and Wade, if you had gotten a bigger contribution from those rookie players, maybe you're able to contend for not just the playoffs, but perhaps a ticket to the Eastern Conference Championship. You know, you never know, a LeBron injury away from perhaps competing, you know, and maybe that's not the most desirable location for the Heat fan base. Maybe they'd want to be at rock bottom so that they can build their way back up to that. I've had people tell me that they would rather be rebuilding from something than rather just kind of hovering in this mediocrity of perhaps a playoff contender, but not a legitimate title contender. I'm not sure. I don't feel the same way. I mean, for Pat Riley, who famously coined a phrase that, you know, losing is misery, I don't know that that was ever a realistic goal for this franchise.
And we got to go back to that press conference that Pat Riley had in that summer of 2014, right before LeBron left, the one that everybody talks about, that line, do you have the guts? Do you have the guts? And you kind of forget what Pat Riley was really talking about. And what he was talking about, he kept mentioning the San Antonio Spurs, the team that, of course, the Heat had just gotten whooped by in the 2014 finals. And he talked about them and the fact that, you know, they were in the 2013 finals and lost to the Heat. And they come back and they're in the 2014 finals and win. Right. This is a team that over the course of several seasons had been in the playoffs, competing and winning 50 games a year. And maybe they don't make the finals every year, but it's not necessarily a failure. What you're just trying to do is give yourself a chance year in and year out. And that is a very telling part of Pat Riley's sort of intention, right? And you can't really judge what a success is and what a success isn't if you don't know the aim of the team. And the aim, based on those comments, was just to basically compete and to just be in the conversation every single season. Now, maybe they don't have the spotlight on them like they always do in the Big Three era or whatever it might be, but they were essentially trying to be the Spurs East in the way that, not the way the Hawks were trying to do it by literally mimicking their playbook and their personnel, but just by being in the conversation every single season. And in to that degree, the Heat have been somewhat successful if we just base it on those intentions, right? Not based on what the fan base thinks or whatever. It doesn't really matter what the fan base thinks because they can't make any decisions. The decision was that they want to compete every year. Now, they have been in the playoffs in two of the last 3 years, right? But they haven't necessarily been in the conversation. They came in third place in the 2015-2016 season in the conference, but they were a game within being in sixth or seventh place. So it really wasn't that big of a deal. So in that respect, I think that they weren't as successful as they hoped. And you go back to the things like Chris Bosh, Goran Dragic possibly underperforming, and things like that, and Dwayne Wade leaving. If all those things work out a different way, maybe Miami is more in the conversation. Maybe they are up there with Toronto and they're more of a Toronto Raptors and less of kind of like this weird in limbo eighth, seventh seed that they are right now. But the one thing I do think has been unsuccessful for Pat Riley is the fact that he has kind of boxed himself into a corner here, which has been largely not his MO. He was always prided on himself and on maintaining roster flexibility. And he's basically given that up, thinking that this group he probably thought this group would be better than it was last year. And better than it probably is. And so in that respect, I think that was a failure to accurately evaluate this group. But other than that, I think, you know, you can look at the roster that the team that he has, the fact that they are in the playoffs so soon after losing LeBron, and that they've got three really good young players to build around: Bam Adebayo, Justice Winslow, Josh Richardson. That's a really big positive too.
When in your mind, though, did the boxing in happen? Like, when did the Heat get into this position where they are what they are right now? They are a very expensive team right now. I'm going to pull up their cap and look at this. And obviously, maybe is it the Whiteside? Like, is it the Whiteside thing?
It was last summer. I mean, 2 summers ago, he gave Whiteside the deal and Tyler Johnson the deal. The Tyler Johnson contract was a bad move after losing Dwayne Wade. They, of course, after LeBron left, they offered Chris Bosh whatever amount of money it took to keep him. After Dwayne Wade left the next year, they did the same thing with Tyler Johnson for some reason, and that was a mistake. Offering Hassan Whiteside that kind of money was also a mistake based on just where the league was trending away from traditional bigs. You could argue that, yeah, Whiteside probably deserved that contract, but Miami might have been more, if they had been more forward-looking, just let him walk or trade him at the deadline before or something like that. But overall, you could get away with those moves, right? If you don't do what you did last summer, which is give Deion Waiters, James Johnson, and all these guys big, long 4-year contracts. That to me was the problem, is sort of overreacting on that 30-11 finish from 2 years ago.
And then you're looking at the sheet, that puts you in a position, you know, next summer where it's, you know, Whiteside has a player option for 27. Mm-hmm. Johnson has a $19 million player option. Dragic has the same thing.
They're all taking it.
Yeah, Wayne Ellington, you know, is going to be a UFA again, and Justice Winslow is going to be a restricted free agent, and goes up like $10 million, has a $10 million cap hold, and could be in a position for a pretty lucrative extension, and that's tough when you're paying, you know, Deion. I love Deion, but he's on the books for $12 million, and Kelly Olynyk's got $13 million, and James Johnson has a $50 million. That's a lot. That's the one thing about the Cavs that I'm very. This summer will tell us more, and it's a little early for us to really know what they're going to do, right? Like, it is a little early for us to say, like, this is what their salary cap situation is going to look like. But signing Kevin Love, it, to me, is an indication that they are willing to spend, but I wonder what that limit is, and I wonder what that means for the guys on their roster. And that, to me, is maybe the trickiest part of this, because what if the Cavs, let's say, are the seventh seed this year? Maybe not conceivable in the East, right? Like, if Kevin Love's really good and Colin Sexton's good enough and Larry Nance makes some strides, and Jetty Osman makes some strides, and JR and Clarkson and Korver and all these guys are good, and maybe Rodney Hood is more like Utah Rodney Hood, or at least is a better version of himself than he was last year. Maybe that's the seventh seed in the East, because it's a pretty bad conference. It's top five goodish teams and a lot of bad. What if that means you're paying George Hill in 2019-20 and JR Smith and Clark, you're cool with keeping Clarkson around and all this stuff? Like, what does that actually get you? And maybe the middle is okay. Like, but I'm sure the Heat don't feel like the middle is okay, right? Like, I feel like you're in a position where you had LeBron, mm-hmm. you had those guys. I mean, the middle's probably not okay, but it's also like when you don't have LeBron and you know, losing Bosh obviously was kind of put an issue in sort of what you could do, put a cap on your ceiling, but. When do you actually decide that, like, you cannot try to be what you're before, and is like playing this middle ground, and like for the Cavs re-signing Kevin Love, for the Heat going back and spending the money they did, is it just delaying the inevitable to some degree? That's maybe these teams are case studies for that over a 10-year period, but I kind of wonder if that's the case.
We'll be back after this break.
I'm quite sure how to answer that, because I mean, again, I think they feel like that there's still a legitimate playoff team that can win. I don't know that they necessarily see themselves as a middle of the road kind of team, but that it could take a break here or there, and maybe, you know, a team at the top of the Eastern Conference kind of falling or sliding due to injury or some other reason, perhaps, and then maybe just enough internal growth from one of your players to all of a sudden take this team to that next level. And you know, Wes hinted at it, that maybe they might have been fooled from that 31-10 finish a couple seasons ago, where they thought, you know, given the right pieces, you add Bam Adebayo, you sign Kelly Olynyk as a free agent, and all of a sudden you have more length and more versatility. You have more internal growth there from some of those players like Richardson and Winslow, and maybe that's enough to take it to another level. And then Deion Waiters went out last year, and I think without his playmaking ability, and I think a lot of Heat fans have forgotten the kind of player he was, you hope that there's some shot-taking ability, some shot-creating ability there that might have been missing last season, and that might be enough to challenge some of those teams in the top. And you know, whether or not that's the right move is, you know, again, that's, it's hard to say. I mean, what is this team competing for? I mean, for a team like Miami that has been to the finals five times over the last, 13 seasons, 12 seasons, they're in a pretty good place. They've made the playoffs pretty consistently during Pat Riley's tenure. They expect to win. They expect to be in the conversation. Maybe they haven't been because things haven't necessarily broken for them, but I think they see themselves as a team capable of making that leap pretty quickly. And so I don't know that they're disappointed in the way things have played out. And I think they still see the assets on the team as movable. And maybe that's a mistake, you know, on their part, because I think they had probably tried to move a few of them this offseason to no avail. And maybe they misjudged how the market would play out. They also assumed that the salary cap would continue to increase, making these contracts seem like less of a mistake. And so they probably assumed that they could trade away a guy like James Johnson to a contender, or maybe Tyler's contract wouldn't be such a burden. Maybe he would have taken a leap and to make it more of a better value, or that Whiteside could be traded. Unfortunately, none of those things played out the way they assumed it would. And that could be a mistake, but they still see themselves as legitimately being one of the teams that can compete for a high number of wins in the Eastern Conference, and possibly the second to third, you know, maybe you can make it all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals if things break just right.
It was sort of a perfect storm for the Heat, right? Because not only do you try to rebuild after LeBron, because there is a selfish part on the part of guys like Mickey Arison and Pat Riley to prove that, hey, we don't need LeBron to be a playoff team. And people kind of look at, oh, you're just a playoff team, as not a big deal in this sort of ring chasing environment, that this media environment that we are all kind of participating in. But if you are the VP of basketball operations like Pat Riley is, or you own a basketball team, there is a lot of pride in saying, we lost LeBron, he walked out on us, and we still are a playoff team. Just that label, a playoff team, means a lot to these guys. So I understand that. And I understand the Cavaliers trying to do the same thing. The big thing here is that for the Heat, yeah, you're trying to rebuild after LeBron and maintain playoff status, but also there was that other thing that, David, you were just talking about how it was that massive cap spike that same offseason, or the offseason after, I should say. And in that, in sort of the because LeBron left late into that 2014 summer. That was not the rebuild summer. This is different than what Cleveland is facing right now. LeBron left relatively earlier in the summer, and so this is the rebuild summer for the Cavaliers. For Miami, it was the following summer, right? And they reacted that following summer by giving out some really big deals and thinking, like you said, that the cap would continue to rise. And that was – so those two things really put them in a bind there, and I think they misjudged both of those things.
You can also – you can also make the point that no one anticipated, you know, that it would be a Golden State – you know, dynasty in 2014. Right. You tried to make whatever moves thinking you could compete. No one foresaw that it was going to be Cleveland versus Golden State for four straight finals runs.
Right. But Miami never played Golden State. Like, they didn't even get to that. Right. They didn't even get to that level. Didn't even, the fact that the Warriors existed, like, didn't even matter for Miami the last 3 or 4 years. Like, didn't even matter. It's just, they didn't react to it. They never even got to the point where they even had to consider playing them in the finals. It was just never even an issue. But for Cleveland, it has been. And so they need to, and that's why this is a little bit different, but there's a lot of similarities too with what the Cavaliers are doing, because, you know, right now, outside of Kevin Love, they have no big contracts on their books 2 years out down the line. And so you could do what Miami is doing now and has done since LeBron left. You can be a playoff team. You can compete. You've got enough good players there. You've got a Kevin Love that you could build around, but you can make the playoffs in the East with that and just several other nice players. Just don't give up the assets, and don't give up your future flexibility And that's the big takeaway from what the Heat did. The Heat could probably you could argue that the Heat could have achieved as much success as they have up to this point since LeBron left with just bargain bin players, without signing Deion Waiters to a 4-year deal or James Johnson to a long-term deal or any of these things. They could have went about it a different way while maintaining the flexibility, keeping draft picks that they could use for future trades and or drafting players that could pop in the NBA. You can get to those things. So that would be, I think, the lesson for Cleveland.
This is where the Cavs path, I think, gets really tricky. I want to know what you guys think about this, because they're in this position where they did a lot to win with LeBron, as they should have, right? And they don't have, you know, a lot of money on the books that it ties them up past next year. I think Larry Nance is going to get an extension. Rodney Hood's contract is going to be interesting. But other than that, you don't really have anyone besides Kevin Love, who you now are paying through 2023 season. No one else has money. Like, Jordan Clarkson is a bad contract. You're done with him in 2 years. You can get through that. They have Osman, they have Sexton, they have Zizic. They have three young guys they like. They're not guys that I would say are your next LeBron, your next face of the franchise, right? That is sort of, I think, part of the reason I'm good with the Kevin Love thing, is because it gives you someone to take some of that visual pressure to move on past LeBron. It is not on Colin Sexton from day one, at least to the degree it might have been if they had like stripped everything away and said, okay, you're going to play 35 minutes a night and you're going to be bad, but it's going to be about you from day one. That's why I sort of like it. And you could flip Love later if you really needed to, probably. They also have, though, because of the Kyle Korver trade, they have a pick that they will lose their first round pick in the next 2 years, one of the next 2 years, if they make the playoffs. I do not get the vibe from them that they're going to tank. But a top 10 pick is 100% the best way to get the type of young talent you need to continue a rebuild, to make a rebuild sustainable, not just for the life of Kevin Love's contract, but into Sexton's next contract, into Osman's.
That pick that they move, that they owe for the Kyle Korver thing, is that it's protected, right? But if it doesn't go, does it then convey into like two second round picks or something?
Yes.
Like that? Okay.
Yeah, so like they basically either are losing a top 10 lottery pick, or would be losing like a first round pick that is not a lottery pick that one of the next 2 years, and then they get their own pick back, or it conveys to 2 second round picks. I think when you look at this roster, it depends on how Sexton is, and we don't know that yet, and it depends on maybe Larry Nance can take a leap or something, and maybe Osman just thrives, and it's possible that these things work out to some degree. But it feels to me like a missed opportunity post LeBron to build the right way, the more sustainable way. If you're going to try to compete, that's fine. But you could probably do that and be a fringe-ish playoff team and still get like the eighth pick in the draft, right? Like, that seems possible. Maybe the East is just that bad that it's not. But like, it seems to me like that would be how you would want to restart your rebuild. And it's a fine line of, okay, we're going to try to compete for the eighth seed, and we want to make sure we have that pick. So even if we don't lose it like 1 year, at least we don't lose it both. Like, getting it at least 1 year to me seems like a smart thing that I would do if I was them. But I kind of don't think it's 100% like a thing they're going to go out of their way to do. And I don't know if that's good or bad yet, or if we can know that it's good or bad.
You could argue, though, that if that pick does convey, right, that they don't, if they don't tank and that Korver, that first round pick for Korver ends up conveying to Atlanta, that if you're a playoff team post LeBron, because the Heat didn't do that, right? If you're a playoff team post LeBron and Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson and Colin Sexton is enough to get you there, maybe you don't really need the first round pick. You know, if it's just going to be, if you're a team that deserves to be picking in the 20s, what good is that pick going to give you anyway? Yeah, you could tank for 1 year, but if the issue is, if the worst thing is that you miss 1 year, right? You draft Colin Sexton in the lottery this year because you were able to get that pick for the Kyrie in the Kyrie interest. You do that, and then you miss the year after that. It's really only 1 year of a first round pick. It's not that big of a deal, right? Because you have all your other first round picks. Like, that's, I think you can miss 1 year. And it's not that dire of a situation. And I wouldn't go as far as to just tank for 1 year just to get there. Because if you tank, if you actively lose, you don't really know what you have. Like, there is a lot of value in trying to figure out what does it look like when you give Kevin Love the rock all the time? Like, what is a Kevin Love built team look like? What is this Cavaliers team? What is Colin Sexton all about? There's so much value in figuring that out that unless you're going to do a 76ers tankathon, right, and do this for several seasons in a row, I don't see the value in just doing it for 1 year just to keep a pick at the price of just sort of punting on figuring out what it is that this team is, right? Because like you said, you don't have a lot of long-term contracts, but you got to figure out what these guys are in the next 2 years before you let them all walk away. You got to figure out what this team is, and you've only got 2 years to do it. And then the rebuild really starts when all these contracts come off.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to you know, your perspective there, and I imagine some Cavaliers fans probably feel pretty bleakly about Cleveland's future there. But I still can't help but think of the fact that, you know, for 11 out of the past 15 seasons, you had possibly the best player in NBA history there that took your team to contention, you know, pretty regularly, certainly for the last four seasons. And that the bleakest time during that stretch was actually the 4 years where you had great draft picks and you were rebuilding and you were pretty much tanking for those draft picks.
You used them on Anthony Bennett.
I was revisiting this.
You're right.
On a radio hit the other day, and oh my God, like you. So, and even just like getting, like, yes, you drafted Kyrie, but you had to get lucky to get that pick because you got the pick that turned into Kyrie because you took on Baron Davis's contract.
Yeah,
like that wasn't their own pick,
and that was a no brainer. Kyrie was obviously the number one player in that draft.
Him or Derek Williams, which that would have been something if Derek Williams would have been the pick there instead of Kyrie. Looking back,
so I mean, I don't know. I mean, does everybody want to go? Do Cavs fans actively want to go through that much losing again? Just for the chance to possibly draft somebody that may turn into Kyrie Irving or could turn into Anthony Bennett? I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily worth it. I mean, Miami, in the 20-some years of Pat Riley's tenure, they've tended to devalue draft picks pretty significantly, and I can't help. And I know I'm in the minority here, even amongst Locked On Heat hosts. I tend to not care about the draft because, to me, it just doesn't seem to matter. The picks have never really – amounted to much in Riley's team.
Other than every player in the league.
No, not every. You got Hassan Whiteside and Tyler Johnson. Two of our starters last year weren't drafted. Josh Richardson, a third starter.
Oh, Whiteside was drafted in second round.
Josh Richardson was a second round pick. So you got two second round picks.
Yeah, those are draft picks.
Yeah.
The draft matters.
It matters. It matters to some degree.
You literally need the draft to stock.
I get it. But I think, you know, you're going to have a bad pick, or you're taking a chance, a mystery box that might not pan out. You had, in Cleveland's perspective, you had Deion Waiters, you had Anthony Bennett, you had Andrew Wiggins. Would you want to be saddled with Wiggins and his contract at this point rather than have the glorious run that you've had for the past 4 years? I don't think so.
I guess there's a difference when you're the Heat front office, which is largely drafted pretty well, right? You could see that there's value in keeping picks, even if it's not tanking and getting a top five pick, but, you know, using your second round picks to draft your next Josh Richardson or whatever. The Cavaliers front office is not drafted well.
No.
And different regime. True. That's a good point, but historically have not done a good job. In a weird way, they have been a free agent destination when LeBron was there. But more so, they built and stocked that roster through trades. But I'll say this, you need the draft pick, like second round picks and first round picks. Those are the things that grease the wheels at the trade deadline. So whether or not you use the player in, like, to use David's term, you use that draft pick to select the mystery box, which can either be a complete bust or a Donovan Mitchell or whatever it might be. But you still need to have those picks in your, you know, under your roof so that you can either use them on rookies or to trade them. And in Miami's case, they used two of them to trade them. And I know I keep bringing this up, but they used two picks to trade for Goran Dragic. And that was based on the value that they gave away. Dragic has not performed like the player that they thought they were getting. So you've got to be really careful when you do that. But all in all, the draft picks are very important in order to move. So just, again, I'm going to go back to this point. Maintain the flexibility. Keep those guys under short-term contracts. The people that you do sign, keep them under short-term contracts unless they're bona fide all-stars. And now you're rebuilding, right? And you can kind of go like an Oklahoma City Thunder route. Or, you know, use those picks in a smart way, whether it be in a trade to go get you know, go play like Houston, go be the Houston Rockets and move a bunch of assets and wind up with James Harden. There's a lot of avenues, and basically you got to keep the avenues open.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest lesson in all this is keep the avenues open. And I mean, do you feel like the Heat are in a position now where like 4 years removed? I mean, obviously we've talked about the salary issues they're facing and not maybe having that flexibility, but like, do you feel like they have gotten to a point where they have like fully moved on from that? Like they are fully just like they are in this different era, right? Like, because that to me is like what I sort of, this is, I'll outline this like this way. I think the Cavs are deciding, okay, we do not want to be irrelevant after LeBron. They know how hard it was to draw in fans in the 4 years without, like, the casual Cleveland person is, it's a tough, basketball is a tougher sell than it is in other cities. Just a fact. You have Kevin Love. He is somehow the last guy standing. He's a title winner. Bring him back. Channing Frye, is bringing him back is really good. Well, good for me as a media member. You still have George Hill. You still have Tristan Thompson. You still have Jerry. You have these guys for a little bit longer. You're going to push Sexton. You're going to pay Larry Nance, I'm pretty sure, maybe 10, 11 million a year. He's a local, likes being there, easy to sell, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're hoping that like manifests itself the way the Pacers did, or the Heat when they went on that 30-11, or what the Jazz did. I think that is what they believe is the sustainable model. But I think Wes is right in saying like, you have to grease that. So like, what is there a lesson for the Heat? And like, you, is it like, what is like the reason you think it just like the, when they did what they did? And did it start with Dragic? Was it a bunch of things? What leads them to ending up being in the position they are now? And like, how, when you look at that, and if you're building a team in the trying to follow in those footsteps to some degree, how do you, what are the things you do to not do that?
I think in Miami's case, you know, they didn't foresee the future. And I think a lot of that, I mean, I know some people have tried to diminish the importance of this, but the Chris Bosh situation can't be understated, because to me, you know, as much as you want to retain those draft picks, let's say that realistically, if it's a fully healthy Chris Bosh playing at the all-star level that he did in Toronto, and you know, with the evolved three-point shot and the consistent level of defense that he played in Miami, and you got that complete and total player, those draft picks are probably going to be in the late 20s. You know, maybe they're an Eastern Conference finalist. Maybe they are at the same point that Toronto has been over the last few years. Maybe they challenge Cleveland a little bit more. Maybe they're one, you know, really good run away from making it to the Eastern Conference Finals and going on to the finals. And, you know,
2014, Chris Bosh was really like, that's a top five player in the East, even after LeBron.
I mean, you still have
Wade, right?
and he's playing at a high level. He played 70 some games after LeBron left. I mean, you know, you acquire Goran Dragic and hope that he's a third all-star that you can pair along there. And then you don't have to, then you bring along Whiteside, but you don't have to pay him the kind of money that you wind up doing a couple seasons later, because Bosh is still your starting center. Or, you know, Whiteside might be a really, really good backup and he doesn't require the kind of minutes and pay that are commensurate for that level of pay. So, you know, you don't know what the future will hold. You try to build it as well as you possibly can. And like Wes has been hammering, you know, trying to stay flexible as much as possible. And I think that they've done an admirable job overall, to be honest with you.
Chris Bosh was really good that next year. He played those 44 games that he played in the first half of the season. People always wondered, and these are the same questions that Kevin Love faces right now. Can you go back to Minnesota, Kevin Love? Can you go back to Toronto, Chris Bosh? And I think that's a kind of, I hate that, because both of them, since moving on to a LeBron James team, had evolved in their own respect. Chris Bosh, I would say more so than Kevin Love, but Kevin Love has completely reshaped his body and even changed the way he plays offense in a lot of different ways. But Chris
Bosh,
much
better shooter now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Chris Bosh, scoring 24 points per game his last year in Toronto, goes to Miami, never scores 20 points per game while LeBron's there. The year that season that Chris Bosh signed the max contract to come back after 2014, after LeBron leaves, goes right back to scoring 20 points per game. He averaged 21 points per game in the 44 games he played the year after LeBron left. 7 rebounds, 2.2 assists per game, almost a whole block per game, almost a whole steal per game. He was really, really good that next year, and he was really, really good the year after that when he got back onto the court for the 50 or so games that he played the season after. And so you hope that if you're Cleveland, that Kevin Love can sort of do that, that he becomes sort of this third version of Kevin Love. You know, you had the first version of Minnesota, you had the second version on the LeBron James Cavs. Is there this third version that that's this, like, you know, evolved form combination of Minnesota Kevin Love next to LeBron James Kevin Love, like Chris Bosh kind of was before, of course, the blood clot issue? And that's what you're hoping that you get from Kevin Love.
I'm very fascinated to just see how this turns out. I have no idea. But I want to wrap it up on sort of like a more non-analytical, just sort of like an emotional question. When you were covering this team and watching the Heat the first year after LeBron, how long did it take you to like realize that it was different? And it was not going to ever be exactly the same as it was when he's there? Because I was much younger when he left the first time, and I don't have that memory to sort of fall back on. And I'm very, very curious to see like how everything does change because he's not there, in terms of the locker room setup, in terms of like what the product is like, what the expectations are like. It seems less stressful already to some degree, to be honest with you. And I'm sort of curious to see.
I think it was pretty similar. I think that 14-15 team, it felt like the free agency moves themselves were a huge contrast, because you had the lowest of lows finding out that LeBron left, and then the highest of highs with Chris Bosh signing. It was probably like the most joyous I felt in a long time. And I think that with that team, there were such lower expectations in 14-15, and you're kind of hoping that they'll be good. But of course, watching them on a regular basis, they're not as dynamic. They're not going to provide as much offense. Their defense is porous. It's just not as good a team, and it never would be. And you know, that's the reality. You try to do what you can. I think we were all very buoyed by the Goran Dragic acquisition. Like, I remember recording a podcast with Wes before we were ever part of the Locked On Network. We recorded a podcast kind of joyously talking about the Dragic acquisition, and then to find out about Chris Bosh's blood clots and knowing that not only would his career be threatened, but that his life might be in jeopardy as well. And that was kind of difficult to stomach. And you know, so you just have to appreciate the growth, the day to day. It's never going to be as good as it has been over the last 4 years. And you kind of just try to move forward and look for little things, look for signs of growth and the team congealing with a lot less pressure and seeing whose personality manifests. Like I'll probably say that Kevin Love, as quiet as he's been over the last 4 years, will probably take on a more vocal role. And that's probably going to be a good thing, because I think he's certainly capable of handling it, and seeing his personality kind of blossom, and as well as some of the other players on that team, seeing their personality blossom without the kind of constant scrutiny that LeBron brings, is going to be a fun thing for Cavs fans to watch.
It's a great point, because LeBron is such a huge personality, right? I mean, he's a class clown. He's a huge locker room presence. He's got such a big impact on just the overall media coverage of the team, too. I mean, he's the only quote that really matters. And so when he leaves that locker room, it has to take on a new personality. So for Cavs fans, they're going to get to see this new personality develop. And not only having Kevin Love back, getting Channing Frye back. I mean, first of all, Kevin Love, one of the most underrated Instagrams in the league. If you're not following him, it's great. He's in the Team USA stuff's a lot of fun right now. Channing Frye in that is a great locker room presence. So I like what they're doing there. And then Chris, you hinted at it before, there is a sense of relief, you know, after, like, you don't, they talk, you know, a lot of people talked about that Heat team in 2014 was just tired. They were so tired of the grind of this expectation of finals win or bust, rings or bust. And that doesn't exist anymore in Cleveland. And there is a relief that comes with that, not only for the fans, but for the players too. And I think that's a real thing. It'll be interesting to see, like what David was saying, to see what you kind of see out of Kevin Love, and you kind of let him blossom now that he's out of LeBron's shadow. I kind of always talked about those years between 2010 and 2014, just like a frat party. Like it's crazy all the time. Everybody's drunk. Everybody's partying. Everybody's having a great time. And all of a sudden you wake up and it's over and you're a little hungover and there's some lingering effects. But overall, it's like, okay, that was a fun Saturday night. Now let me just take my lazy Sunday and I'll worry about the future on Monday. But let me just take this lazy Sunday for a while. And I think that's where Cleveland's at right now. Just take this lazy Sunday, do your draft Colin Sexton, bring back Kevin Love. But mostly it's a lazy Sunday. And then down the road, just, you know, take it for what it is. And then down the road, figure out the future. But for now, just enjoy it. Take some Advil and just chill on the couch for a while and watch Bar Rescue or something or whatever people do.
Sip a nice mimosa, get some coffee in your system, and
look, I may be speaking from experience, but yeah. Yeah. Have a cup of coffee yeah. And then just hang out for a while and just relax.
Yeah.
It's been a good four years. Just relax.
Yeah. I'm really excited about this, to be honest. Selfishly, there's something about it that is sort of new, and I find that kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. It'll never be quite as magnified and everything, and covering the finals was like a wild experience, but I'm sort of excited to be like one of these like more quiet moments. But guys, are you enjoying your summer? Like, to wrap this full circle, like, are you like ready for basketball to be back? Cause I need like another like month, I think, before like I get NBA back. I need to just like chill for a little bit and then I'll be good. But I'm getting,
I think it's different for us. Like Wes was saying before, it's been so quiet for us for so long now. An early round exit for Miami, and then, you know, free agency wasn't really much of an issue other than signing Derrick Jones Jr. So I mean, for the draft wasn't a factor. It's nothing like to fully engage the Heat fan and us, I think. So I'm kind of looking forward to basketball coming back soon, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm good right now. I can wait a little bit longer, but I like having my evenings. I watched the news the other day at like 6 o'clock at night. That was weird.
That's super depressing and old, Wes.
That's when I know it's the off season. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. At night I usually watch sports. Now it's like baseball's on and I have to like click through those channels.
Yeah.
Very weird. So other than that, yeah, I guess I would like to have something to watch other than Donald Trump and whatever baseball. I can't name a baseball player, so.
I went to a preseason European soccer game in Pittsburgh the other day and was like, oh, this is what people do and this is terrible. Oh,
the World Cup was fun. That was really cool was great. For the summer. I enjoyed that. And then Tiger Woods at the Open, that was fun. So those were some good sports moments.
That was the most unified basketball Twitter had been in weeks was Tiger Woods playing well again.
Yes. Is Miguel Cabrera still in the MLB? Do we know that?
Yeah, plays for the Tigers.
Is he still a baseball player?
Right, plays so for the one baseball for the, player. For the tanking Detroit Tigers. Well, we're talking about baseball now. So listeners, thank you so much for listening. Subscribe to Locked On Cavs and Locked On Heat on iTunes, Megaphone, Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts. 5-star ratings and reviews are the best way to support the show. You can, each of our shows respectively, find me on Twitter and Facebook at CWMRant. Guys, just let everyone know where they can find
Twitter you. At DRamil13. You can catch all my writing there. And of course, our podcast at Locked On Heat.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg, but go follow the Twitter account at Locked On Heat because we need more followers there. So that'd be nice.
Followers are nice. Well, everyone, thanks for listening. Enjoy your basketball free life. Go do something fun. And you'll hear from both of us soon. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. One last thing before you go. If you run a company and you're unhappy with your return from advertising online or in print, try something new and advertise on a podcast here at Locked On Heat. This is a great opportunity for local South Florida businesses to connect with Heat fans. More and more people are listening every day. 50% of U.S. households listen to a podcast, and 1 in 5 Americans between ages 18 and 49 listen to at least one a month. That's according to Nielsen. Thanks to the rise in mobile options from iTunes to Spotify and more, if you're a smart speaker at home, there's more ways than ever to listen to podcasts. Now is the time to get in. Be ahead of your competition and start advertising on a podcast with us. Our rates are reasonable and based on the number of listens, so you get what you pay for, with numbers to back it up. Whereas print, TV, and radio ads are a shot in the dark. You have no idea who is reading, watching, or listening. That's not the case with podcasts. If you want to reach engaged, passionate, and knowledgeable South Floridians, this is the way to do it. For more information on next steps, email us at lockedonheat@gmail.com, and we could be talking about your company on the next episode.